Welcome to the 259th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are an overview of Patrick's weekend predictions, a look at the NBA playoffs, and our weekly review of Major League Baseball action. So let's jump right in with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our website, 4thand24.com. And we will start in the NBA, where Patrick went 2-2 with his predictions. In Major League Baseball, Patrick went 2-2 with his weekend series prediction, so that gives him a total of 4-4 for this past week, and that brings him to a 1,056-681 overall record, a 60.8% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on this week's predictions?
Well, I thought overall it was a decent week. There were a few close games. I think by far the most unexpected result was the Timberwolves beating the Nuggets to open up that series, but we'll talk about it more later. The Pacers clinched the series against the Bucks at home, which I think was pretty predictable going into the series, honestly. The Knicks beat the 76ers 118-115. I did not expect them to actually go on the road and clinch that after the Sixers had taken game five on the road in New York. And then the Magic beat the Cavs 103-96, which a good game by the Magic there to force it to a game seven. But of course, home team ended up winning every single game of that series. So ended up going 2-2, predicting those Pacers and Magic wins correctly. But overall, I guess technically now really surprising results when you think about how those series unfolded. And well, especially with what happened in the rest of the Timberwolves series, but we'll talk about that in a second. In MLB, I thought the Dodgers and the Braves had pretty even pitching matchups. I thought that the Braves would win the Fried start and the Dodgers would win the Glasnow start, and whoever won the first game would win the series. But Dodgers offense got so hot over the weekend that it didn't actually matter. The Dodgers won the Fried start and won the first start of the series and then won the Glasnow start, like I thought, by a lot of runs. So very interesting series there. The Dodgers won that first game in extra innings and ended up with that sweep. I played the emotional hedge to pick the Braves instead of the Dodgers and, didn't get a correct prediction out of it, but still a very fun series to watch between the two favorites in the NL, obviously heading into the season, but not the two best records, as we'll talk about later. Then the Cubs took 2 of 3 from the Brewers. They dropped the first game in the series, came back, won the next two. The Rangers took 2 of 3 from the Royals. Same situation there. They lost the first game of the series and then took 2 of 3 there. That was the other prediction I got wrong. I got the Cubs prediction right, and then the Yankees swept the Tigers, which was a prediction that I got right. So overall, I'm okay with the week. Maybe with no emotional hedges and, one close NBA game going my way, all of a sudden you're talking about 6-2 instead of 4-4. So overall, I think a pretty good week for me, and I'm not too dissatisfied with the results.
All right. Well, we will see how satisfied you are with next weekend's predictions in our next podcast. Those predictions will be posted on our website, as always, on Thursday. Let's now turn our attention to the NBA, which you mentioned a little bit. We will start with action in the Western Conference first round, where the number 5-seeded Dallas Mavericks beat the number 4-seeded Clippers.
Yeah, the Mavericks were tied with the Clippers after the first four games of the series, but went on to win game five on the road in LA, 123-93, and then came back home and clinched it 114-101. The Clippers, I'd say their best game that they played throughout the series was game four, where they just came out on fire offensively. But without doing that, they really never had much of a chance in this series, especially without Kawhi Leonard. They just couldn't get enough offensive production going. In this final game, they had no players hit over 6 field goals. No players hit more than 2 threes. The only player to have 20 points was Norman Powell off the bench. Paul George had 18 points. James Harden had 16 points. He missed all 6 of the threes he took. And then on the other side of things, Luka Doncic had a terrible shooting night, had 28 points, though still 13 assists for him, 7 rebounds. Him and James Harden pretty much canceled each other out with Luka getting the free throw line a little bit more, but still being a little bit more efficient, I think, technically by math, but still both bad games on both sides, honestly. But PJ Washington had 14 points pretty efficiently. Daniel Gafford had 13 points. He was also efficient. Derek Lively had 10 points, didn't miss a shot, 9 rebounds as well. And then Kyrie Irving had 30 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists on 11 of 19 shooting. That was exactly what Dallas needed to close out that series. And, in game three, it was really just a big night by Luka. He had 35 points. Kyrie only had 14. No one else on the Mavs actually had more than 15, but Luka had 35, 10 assists, 7 rebounds on 14 of 26 shooting. And that was just way too much for the Clippers to overcome, considering Paul George and James Harden combined to shoot 6 of 25 from the field. And only had 22 points. They just can't do that if Kyrie is going to, or sorry, if Kawhi is going to be out, and he was out. So those are just performances that you can't overcome when you already have a big three and one of them is already down. Your other two parts of your big three just can't be that bad. And they were throughout the series, frankly. So Dallas able to take that series as a result.
All right, we'll move over to Eastern Conference first round action, starting with the number one seeded Boston Celtics defeating the number 8 seed of Miami Heat in 5 games.
Yeah, this one was pretty predictable. I mean, I think most people are surprised that the Heat even got a game off the Celtics, but in game 5, Boston won 118-84 to close it out. Bam Adebayo tried his best. He had 23 points, 6 assists, 5 rebounds, but 10 of 26 shooting for a big man who doesn't even step out to shoot threes is really bad, honestly. Tyler Hero was 6 of 19 from the floor, and that was the second best scoring number that the Heat got. He had 15 points on the game, so just a rough game overall for Miami. Meanwhile, the Celtics got 25 points from Jaylen Brown on 11 of 19 shooting, 25 points from Derek White on 8 of 13 shooting, 17 points from Sam Hauser off the bench on 6 of 10 shooting. Jason Tatum only scored 16 points. I mean, people are making jokes about him playing like a role player, which honestly, in this series, in this game, he kind of did. But it didn't matter because the Celtics are just so much better than the Heat overall that, you know, they have 4 or 5 players scoring better than the Heat's best players when Jimmy Butler is out. So it wasn't a fair series on paper, and it turned out to be that way, especially in game 5.
All right, we'll move over to the 2-7 matchup where the New York Knicks defeated the Sixers in 6 games.
Yeah, this one was definitely the most entertaining series. I think you could argue throughout the first round, maybe even in both leagues, honestly, all the games were close. A lot of buzzer beaters, or not necessarily buzzer beaters, but a lot of action at the end of games. One overtime game in game 5, that was the overtime game. The Sixers won 112-106 in overtime. Look, the Knicks, it looked like they were going to clinch the series in 5 at home, but Tyrese Maxey came out of nowhere at the very end of the game, scored seven straight points, actually got an and one on a three, and then also hit a deep three to send the game to overtime. And then the Sixers took it over in overtime. Maxey had 46 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists. Joel Embiid had 19 points, 16 rebounds, 10 assists, his first career triple-double, if you can believe that. And then on the Knicks side of things, Jalen Brunson had 40 points, but no one else really had any ridiculous shooting nights like they were accustomed to getting earlier in the series. And I think if they had gotten one of those, either from Josh Hart, from OG Anunoby, from Dante DiVincenzo, then they probably win this game in regulation. But they didn't get one of those performances, so instead Philly forced Game 6, brought it back to Philly, but then the Knicks, they were able to weather the storm, had a great game in Philly. Every starter scored 14 points or more. When you consider that Isaiah Hartenstein only averages about 8 per game in the regular season, him scoring 14 points is a big boost. Josh Hart had 16 points, 14 rebounds, 7 assists. Dante DiVincenzo had 23 points and 7 assists. OG Anunoby had 19 points and 9 assists. And of course, Jalen Brunson had 40 once again, 41 points, 12 assists. Just too much for the Sixers to handle, even though Joel Embiid had 39 points of his own. Tyrese Maxey only had 17, and that wasn't enough, despite even getting 6 threes from Buddy Hield off the bench. So they got some, the Sixers got some lift off the bench and from some unexpected sources to keep that game close, but it just wasn't enough to win the series, and that's why New York walked away with the victory.
All right, let's move over to the number 6-3 game, which is the 6-seeded Pacers beating the number 3-seeded Bucks in 6 games.
Yep, the Bucks won game 5, 115-192 at home. They forced that game 6, which was honestly very surprising if you think about it, because the Bucks did not have Dame, did not have Giannis in this game, and yet they were able to force the Pacers to, you know, take some bad shots throughout the game, got just enough offense of their own. Bobby Portis and Chris Middleton had 29 points each, very efficient from the floor as well. Pat Bev had 13, Malik Beasley had 18, Brooke Lopez had 12. So, you know, it was balanced scoring from the starters. And then on the Pacers side of things, not getting enough from anybody. No one over 16 points in the entire game. And Tyrese Halliburton only had 6 assists as well. So you know, just the Pacers not really playing their normal game, but they were able to flip that in game six, got back to what they normally do, ran up the pace, played super, super fast. Even with Dame back for the Bucks, he did have 28 points, but it wasn't enough. Chris Middleton had kind of his first off game of the series. Pascal Siakam had 19 points on an efficient 9 of 15 shooting. Aaron Nesmith had 15. Andrew Nembhard had 14 points. Halliburton had 17, 10, and 6. And then off the bench, TJ McConnell had 20 points and 9 assists. And Obi Toppin had 21 points and 8 rebounds. So the Pacers just had, what, 6 players that had 14 points or more. And that was just way too much for the Bucks to overcome. They got so many balanced contributions, both from their second unit and from the first unit. And despite a pretty bad game from Miles Turner, who had been on fire throughout the series, the Pacers were able to easily blow out the Bucks and end the series.
And then finally, in first round action, the last series, number 4 seeded Cleveland Cavaliers beat the number 5 seeded Orlando Magic in 7 games.
Yep, home team continued to win every single game of this series all the way until the end. Just something that, frankly, you don't see very often. But look, starting with game 5, the Cavs won 104 to 103. A big block near the end of the game, actually, the reason why they win this one as Evan Mobley blocked Franz Wagner going for the game-tying layup. Looking at more individual performances, this was the first game Paolo Banchero really stepped up to the challenge on the road in the series. He had 39 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists. Franz Wagner, not his greatest game, 14.6 assists, 5 rebounds, only 3 of 11 from the floor. Jalen Suggs was the only other player in double figures on the Magic, scoring 13, but on 5 of 14 shooting an 0 of 5 from 3. So just really off shooting night for the Magic. They shot 9 of 31 as a team from 3, which is 29% if you're doing the math at home. On the Cleveland side of things, despite how widespread the Magic scoring was and really inconsistent was outside of Paolo Banchero, Cleveland got some pretty good streamlined scoring from all their good players. Evan Mobley had 14 points, 13 rebounds, 7 of 11 shooting. Donovan Mitchell had 28 points, 6 rebounds. Darius Garland had 23, 5 and 5. Max Strus had 16, 5 and 6. Marcus Morris came off the bench and had 12 points and 3 rebounds. He wasn't even in the rotation for the first part of the series, but they started to bring him in later in the series, and all of a sudden they had cut that actually kind of flipped the last 3 games. It really felt like it flipped the energy. Obviously that, of course, was because of the Jared Allen injury that he was playing, but at the same time, it was still a change that made the most sense. Credit to JB Bickerstaff for pressing the right button, because he could have still played some other players on their roster, and instead he went with Morris, and I would say it paid off throughout the series. That continued into game 6. Another close game, but this time the Magic pulling away with it. Paolo Banchero in this game, and Franz Wagner and Jalen Suggs all had over 20 points. Paolo, 27 points on 9 of 20 shooting, 8 rebounds, 4 assists to go with that. Franz Wagner had 26 points on 7 of 16 shooting. Jalen Suggs had 22 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists. And then no one else in double figures other than Wendell Carter, who had 11 points. But overall, a really good performance by the Magic to avoid losing the series, especially because Donovan Mitchell had 50 points. No one else on the Cavs other than Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland did virtually anything in this game. Donovan Mitchell had 50 points. Darius Garland had 21. Max Strus had 10. The next highest contribution from any player on this team was 4 points from Isaac Okoro off the bench. That is something that you just cannot win a game with. Donovan Mitchell did completely take over the game. He did take 36 shots, so it was hard. It was hard for anybody else to really get points because he was kind of taking all the shots. But hey, he made 22 of them, so he was shooting over 50% on his own. The rest of the team shot 20 of 50 from the field. So yeah, you'd rather have Mitchell shooting. He made 2 more shots in 14 less attempts. And then Darius Garland had 10 of 7, was 10 of 17 from the floor too. So he had a pretty good game too. But those two tried to carry the Cavs to the win. The Magic just had a little bit too much to bring themselves over the hump in that game and win. But then in game 7, it flipped once again. Paolo Banchero had another solid game scoring-wise. He had 38 points Also had 16 rebounds, but the issue was he was very, very inefficient. Just 10 of 28 from the field, had 15 of those 38 points from the free throw line. And then Franz Wagner went 1 of 15, so that was just way too much for them to overcome. Jalen Suggs went 2 of 13. Really, you know, a young team just kind of cracked under the pressure. I think that's really the best way you can describe what happened in the series. And on the other side of things, the team that's, you know, not old, but definitely way more experienced than the Magic, has been in the playoffs recently, they played better. They made sure to not crack under the pressure. Donovan Mitchell had 39 points on 11 of 27 shooting, so pretty much as inefficient as Paolo. But both of them, you know, taking a lot of the shots for their teams. Donovan Mitchell added in 5 assists and 9 rebounds. Evan Mobley, 11 points, 16 rebounds for him. Caris LeVert finally got it going off the bench, scoring 15 for the Cavs. Second on the team, actually, in scoring in this game. And then Max Strus had 13 points. Darius Garland had 12, not his best shooting night. And look, the Cavs played the final three games of the series without Jared Allen, and they were still able to come away with the series victory. So, you know, they escaped those two close games at home. Now they have the big challenge of taking on the Boston Celtics, which we will talk about in a second.
Yeah, that was a very entertaining series, including the last game. But let's turn our attention now to the semifinals after those first-round series are all over. We'll start back in the West, where the number 3-seeded Minnesota Timberwolves lead the number 2-seeded and defending NBA champion Denver Nuggets 2-0.
Yeah, this one is probably the biggest surprise of the postseason so far. I think it's not really close either. Minnesota jumping out to a 2-0 lead on the road against the defending champs. You know, if they had home field, it'd be different. If this was the 2-3 series, you know, the other way around with Minnesota hosting the first two games, I don't think people would be too surprised. But considering that the Nuggets did have that tiebreaker and they're the ones hosting, I think it is surprising. I don't think many people had the Wolves jumping out to a 2-0 series lead over the defending champs on the road. But here we are. It started in game one. Anthony Edwards, 43 points on 17 of 29 shooting. He's just been ridiculous all postseason long. And, you know, that continued in that first game. Rudy Gobert had 6 points, 13 rebounds. Karl Anthony Towns had 20 points on 8 of 13 shooting. But this game is all about Ant and about Naz Reid off the bench, who had 16 points on 7 of 11 shooting and played some pretty good defense on Nikola Jokic, I might mention. And overall, by the way, in the first two games of the series, the Timberwolves defense has been great on the Nuggets. That, I think, is the number one reason why they're winning this series. 106 points is nothing crazy in today's NBA. It's the defense that's kind of carrying them through this series. And, you know, that is something they can lean on. They have Rudy Gobert. They have Jaden McDaniels. Nikhil Alexander-Walker has been great on defense. Naz Reid has been great on defense. Anthony Edwards is one of the better defenders out of all the big scoring stars in the league. So, you know, it is something that you could say is the Timberwolves' calling card, but if they're going to keep playing defense like this, it's going to be really hard for Denver to win this series, especially being down 2-0 already. Then on Denver's side of things in game one, though, Nikola Jokic, 32 points, 9 assists, 8 rebounds. I would say for him, that's technically a below average performance, even though that's a ridiculous performance overall, but just a little bit below where he normally is in the playoffs. Jamal Murray had 17 points on 6 of 14 shooting, but he didn't make a shot in the first half at all. And he actually didn't make a shot in the first half until the middle of game two, which we'll talk about in a second. But Michael Porter Jr., 20 points on 4 threes. And then in game two, it was more of the same, except for even more offensive struggles from Denver. Anthony Edwards didn't really put his imprint on this game early. It was really Cat who was doing it. They both ended up with 27 points, 27 and 12 for Karl Anthony Towns, 27, 7 and 2 for Anthony Edwards. Ant shot 11 of 17 from the floor, Karl Anthony Towns 10 of 15. And then the rest of the contributions for the Timberwolves were really off the bench. Naz Reid with 14 points and Nikhil Alexander-Walker with 14 points. So both of those two kind of picking up the pieces where the Timberwolves needed it, because there was no Rudy Gobert in this game. He was out for the birth of his first child. And somehow Nikola Jokic, only 16 points without Rudy Gobert on the floor, 5 of 13 from the field, 16 points, 16 rebounds, 8 assists for him. Again, as crazy as it is to say, for him, that's a pedestrian night. But you know, for other players in the league, that'd be like their best game of all time. But if you want to talk about pedestrian, you know, Michael Porter only had 9 points in this game, 4 of 12 from the field, 1 of 7 from three. I'd call that pedestrian. And then I wouldn't even call this pedestrian. Jamal Murray was awful yesterday. 8 points, 3 of 18 shooting, 13 rebounds is all he could really contribute with. Only 2 assists in the game as well. He was awful. I mean, it is what it is. Aaron Gordon led this team in 3-point shooting in terms of the starters. Justin Holiday had 4 threes off the bench with 13 points. But if your third best scorer is going to be Justin Holiday with 13 points off the bench in a game where you get 20 points from Aaron Gordon, they're not going to win the series. And that is the thing. Denver only able to muster up 80 points in this game. And I really don't think it was just, yes, I think they, in some aspects, yeah, they missed a few shots they probably would normally make, but it wasn't just missing shots. It was some great defense by Minnesota to limit them and force them to take bad shots. So it's really interesting to see how this series could unfold. I'd say right now, I think everybody would probably agree that Minnesota's favored to win this series. They have 3 games left at home. Already having beaten the Nuggets twice on the road, they just need to win 2 out of 3 at home, even if they drop all the remaining road games in the series, and they win the series in six. So I think they're going to do it at this point. I didn't expect the Nuggets to come out so flat trying to tie the series up at one, especially without Rudy Gobert on the floor for Minnesota. But here we are. Now you have the Timberwolves in the lead 2-0 in the series.
All right. And the other series, which is yet to start, we've got the number one seeded Oklahoma City Thunder against the 5-seed Dallas Mavericks. Patrick, your prediction for that series?
Yeah, I have OKC winning this series in 7 games. I think that, you know, there's definitely an experience difference there. And the Mavericks, you know, they are more of a playoff tested team, but I think OKC has been the better team throughout the year. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is going to be able to equal whatever Luka Doncic does in his own way. I know he's not as much of a triple double threat as Luka, but you know, you could argue that if he's given the reins to really, really go off, he probably would be a better scorer. I mean, Luka just has the ball in his hands like all the time for Dallas, whereas Shai tends to divert to his other player. Yeah, tends to divert and let his other players go to work a little bit more. But overall, I do think OKC wins this series. I think it's really close. I'd say that, you know, I always end up picking a team closing it out at home pretty much unless I'm predicting a sweep. And in this series, just because Dallas has played really well at home, and I think it is a really close series on paper. And considering how Dallas has played at home throughout the playoffs, I guess there's a path where OKC does play really well in game six and beat them on the road there, but I don't see it happening. So I'm just going to say OKC wins in 7.
All right, let's move over to the Eastern Conference semis, where you've got the 6-seeded Indiana Pacers against the number 2-seeded New York Knicks. And one of the series that's played the only game so far in the Eastern Conference semis.
Yeah, this series is literally the exact opposite styles. This is like, I don't even know what analogy I could come up with. But this is one of the fastest teams in the league against one of the slowest defensive-minded teams in the league. But you know what? It was an entertaining game last night. Both teams shot very well from the floor, and as a result, you had a 121-117 game. Look, It's just the Knicks starters. They don't even rely on their bench pretty much at all. The bench combined to just take 3 shots in the entire game. They only played 27 minutes total of bench guys, which is the most Tom Thibodeau thing ever. But Dante DiVincenzo had 25 points, 5 of 9 from three in this game. Josh Hart had 24 points, 8 assists, 13 rebounds on 9 of 13 shooting. Jalen Brunson had 43, 6 and 6 on 14 of 26 shooting. Isaiah Hartenstein had 13 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists on 5 of 9 shooting. OG Anunoby, 13 points, 9 rebounds, 4 assists on 5 of 14 shooting. That's the worst performance you could find in their starting lineup. But the Knicks just played their game. They played a good game, strong on defense, got the clutch points when they needed it. The Pacers definitely made a few runs to take control of this game, but the Knicks never really let it get out of the range. That, you know, it wouldn't have been a competitive game. And as a result, by the end of the game, they came through in the clutch, hit the bigger shots when it mattered the most. And despite the Pacers getting 23 points from Miles Turner, 19 from Siakam, 12 from Nesmith and Toppin, 18 from TJ McConnell, they only got 6 points and 8 assists from Tyrese Halliburton. Just wasn't as assertive, pretty much the exact same start as the Milwaukee series had. So If Haliburton can be a little bit more assertive in game two, that's something you would like to see if you're rooting for the Pacers. But other than that, the Knicks came out and played a decent game in game one. I think both teams can play better. And I don't necessarily think that means, 130 to 125 is going to be the score. But, I think both teams just can play a better, cleaner game overall, whether that means it's in more possessions or fewer possessions. But I do think both teams can improve going into game two. But I do think that the Knicks will probably win this series. I think they're the better team. And, Tyrese Haliburton still dealing with those back spasms that affected him in game one. I think that just the Knicks with their home, the Knicks having home court advantage in Madison Square Garden with this team is just a really big advantage, especially the way they're playing right now. So I'm going to give them the edge in the series. And I think that'll continue throughout.
All right, well, the other series features the number one seeded Boston Celtics against the number four seeded Cleveland Cavs. Series is yet to start. Patrick, your prediction for that series?
Well, I think Boston wins in six. Again, I'm going with the trend of, well, actually, sorry, I'm going against the trend of teams clinching at home. The reason why is because the Celtics, for some reason, don't win home games in the playoffs. The only game they dropped to the Heat was at home. So they won both of the two games on the road pretty easily. But the two home games at the beginning of the series were the closest two games of the series, somehow, including the Heat winning that game two. So I think the Celtics randomly drop game one or two. They seem to just do that for whatever reason. But I still think they're a good enough team to win this series pretty comfortably. I don't see Cleveland dragging this out to seven. The only reason I'm picking it in six instead of in five is just because I think Boston has this weird tendency to just lose an extra game at home early in the series. Otherwise, I'd have Boston in five. But I am sticking with Boston in six. They'll drop one home game, who knows why, and then they'll bounce back and win on the road to even it out and win the series.
All right, well, that wraps up our look at the NBA playoffs. We'll now turn our attention to Major League Baseball action with a review of the last week in MLB, starting as always in the American League East.
Well, you have the Baltimore Orioles in first, 23-11 is their record. It's second best in the league now. We'll talk about who's first later. But they have won four in a row. They're 7-3 in their last 10. This division overall, though, pretty strong. The Yankees sitting at 23-13, just one game back of Baltimore, 6-4 in their last 10. They've won three in a row. Boston at 19-16 is in third. And then you have the Tampa Bay Rays at 18-18. They have won four in a row, but have had a pretty weak year, especially from a pitching perspective, which is surprising considering how they normally play. And then Toronto in last at 16-19. Look, this should be a close division throughout the year. You could argue that top to bottom, it's the best division in baseball. There are, a few divisions that would be able to argue that, including the next one we're about to talk about it. If ne the next one we're about to talk about, excuse me, if they didn't have the team they have in last place. But because the Blue Jays are the last place team, I think that gives it more depth overall in the AL East than some of the other divisions have. But Baltimore playing well, Yankees playing pretty well. Overall, I think those two definitely are the favorites in this division. I mean, I think before the season, I predicted that the Orioles would win the division regular season wise, but the Yankees would go farther in the playoffs, I think is what I said. Because, I think the Yankees have that experience, but Baltimore definitely a deep team geared to win a lot of games throughout the regular season. But I just don't think they're a better suited team for the playoffs. The Yankees feel like we'll have better pitching and might trade for some before the end of the year. But speaking of good pitching, the Cleveland Guardians in first in the AL Central. They are 23-12, just 5-5 in their last 10, but they have won three in a row. But it is worth mentioning that creeping up right behind them are the Minnesota Twins at 20-14. They won 12 in a row before Sunday, or before losing the last game of the series on Sunday to the Red Sox. Yes, they played the White Sox for seven of those 13 games, but the fact of the matter is, that's hard to do. It doesn't matter who you're playing. It's really, really hard to just continually win, especially after the start that the Twins had to the season. It wasn't really a great start for them, but they've picked it up. So they are now only 2.5 games back, 9-1 in their last 10. Like I said, they've won 12, 13. Then you have the Royals who are tied with the Twins. I guess different winning percentage, same technical record, 21-15. The Royals are at on the season. Better best pitching in this division, best pitching in the American League other than Seattle, which we'll talk about later. But they are 5-5 in their last 10. They just dropped that series over the weekend to the Rangers, but they're still playing good baseball overall. I think this is a sustainable model for this team. They were built pretty strong. They were built with a pretty strong pitching staff. So I think I expect this to continue. If they can keep up the run production at the level it's at, which is really, I wouldn't call it a level that's super unsustainable. They're like a little bit above average. And I think they have a roster that's, you know, about average. So combined with the support they're getting from the pitching staff, I think it makes sense that they've had this type of production. Then you have the Tigers. They've lost four in a row. They're still above 500 though at 18-17. I don't think staying near 500 is going to be enough to get a playoff spot in the AL, but this is still a step in the right direction for the Tigers regardless. And I think it will continue throughout the year. They'll be a competitive team. I just don't know if they're going to be a playoff team given how deep the league is overall in the American League. And then of course you have the White Sox, the only team that is bringing down the argument for the AL Central being the best division, because they are 8-27, one of the worst teams in baseball. Actually, they are the worst team in baseball. I had to go. Or no, they're not. There is one team that's worse. Well, it's debatable. There's definitely a big three at the bottom in terms of, maybe not a big three, I guess a little three of really terrible teams. But the White Sox are one of those teams. Minus 88 run differential. Just scored their 100th run of the season, even though they've already played 35 games, which is really, really embarrassing. But they're somehow 5-5 in their last 10, though. So I guess that means they've technically been playing better. Then you have the Rangers. They finally took back first place in the AL West. They've won three in a row. They are 7-3 in their last 10. But just a half game behind them are the Seattle Mariners at 19-16. This team is just being run by its pitching staff. 114 runs allowed is just a ridiculous number. To put up the best pitching staff in the league. I think their starters have allowed fewer than a run per game, or maybe a little bit over a run per game over the last 20 games or something like that. And it's just ridiculous what this team has on its pitching staff. They're so talented. And as a result, that's what's carrying them. Their offense has honestly not been that good. They have, if you look at the American League, they've scored the least amount of runs in their division. The least amount of runs in the American League overall, other than the White Sox. So that's really, really bad on offense. They just have enough pitching that it doesn't matter, and they're still above 500. So if they can get any offensive production, just get to average offensive production for the rest of the season, they'll be a dominant team, honestly. They're not going to be, you know, up there record-wise with the Orioles and the Yankees, but they can at least be a team that competes for this division and probably could win this division considering how some of the other teams are playing. And speaking of those other teams, the A's actually being competitive, 17-19. They have lost two in a row, but they're 7-3 in their last 10. And they, at some point this week, were 17-17, which is crazy to say, but they're actually not horrible. They're just not that bad. I mean, I don't really have anything good to say about them, but they're not horrible. If you want to talk about horrible, though, you can talk about the Astros. They are 12-22 on the season, 5-5 in their last 10. Their pitching staff hasn't been good. Their offense has been below expectations. Jose Abreu had to get sent down to the minors to fix his swing and, you know, just get back on track in general, because they just couldn't keep giving big league at bats to him the way he was performing. And then you have the Angels, who are 12-23. They're not as banged up injury wise as the Astros. They just don't have a good roster in the first place. They're 2-8 in their last 10. Although it is worth mentioning that Mike Trout is now injured, but you know, you could say he was the engine that made them go, but they weren't really going anywhere in the first place. So I don't really think that makes any sense. But you know what? Obviously, no Mike Trout is going to make a difference for the Angels. And unfortunately, that is the position they find themselves in once again. And this year, obviously, no Ohtani to plug that hole, and no Rendon either, because he is, of course, injured as always. So the Angels just not having anything on offense. I don't know what they can do about that, really. In general, their roster is just not built to be good, and it hasn't played good well so far.
All right. Well, before we move to the National League, you did fail to mention that the Twins' 12-game win streak was apparently spurred by a lucky summer sausage. Refrigerated and wasn't. So maybe we'll figure out whether that thing got thrown away or whether somebody dared eat it. But one of the stranger good luck charms I've seen in sports recently. All right. Let's move off that serious news to the National League, starting in the East.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I just know that they lost a game on Sunday, but the Phillies speaking of good performances, best record in the majors now, 25-11, after winning six in a row. The Braves enter the weekend in first place in their division with the best record in the NL. They leave the weekend after getting swept by the Dodgers in second place in their division, and not even close to the best record in the National League because of that other team that they played that we'll talk about later. But the Phillies are the team that do have the best record in the National League, 9-1 in their last 10. They have won six games in a row, playing really great baseball right now. That included a four-game sweep over the Giants from Friday to Monday, that odd weekend wraparound series that sometimes gets played. And like I said, Braves got swept over the weekend, did not play on Monday. So they're currently on a three-game losing streak. They played the Dodgers. It is what it is. I'm not worried about them long-term. This was just, you know, one of those things. You run into a team that is better than you, evenly matched with you, playing better baseball, whatever, however you want to say it. I mean, I don't really think it's getting into semantics, whether you're calling the Dodgers or the Braves better on the roster. I think, you know, they just ran into a team that's at least at their level, if not better, at the completely wrong time to play them, because the Dodgers are on fire right now. And no matter what the Braves did, the Dodgers just had too much. And the Braves really haven't hit their stride offensively just yet either. So they'll get better as the season goes on. They do need some pitching reinforcements, though, especially with Spencer Strider out. Although Fried and Morton are definitely holding down the rotation well, and even Reynaldo Lopez has been good to start the season. Then you have the Nationals there at 17-17. You know, I wouldn't say I'm surprised by this team being competitive, because they were kind of competitive at the end of the year last year, and they're a young team. So, you know, they get better on a more exponential rate, or at a more exponential rate than the older teams do. And this year that's starting to show up. They fought through some injuries. They have some good pitching going. All the players from the Padres trade for Juan Soto have been pretty good. CJ Abrams having a great season, Mackenzie Gore having a great season. His ERA is in the threes. CJ Abrams looking like a guy who's probably going to be a 2020 guy this year, maybe even a 30-30 guy if he really picks it up. But 7-3 in their last 10, they're playing good baseball. I think they're a decent team, not a playoff team, but you know, one of those pesky teams that can take a series off you if you're not paying attention. And then the Mets at 17-18. Same position as the Nationals, but if you kind of flipped the age scale of the team, I guess is how I would describe them. You know, 4-6 in their last 10, nothing special, nothing terrible. I guess you could call them a playoff contender. It's really hard because, you know, I'm looking at going from the American League to the National League. I want to say all these teams aren't playoff contenders, but then I'm looking at it and the Padres and the Nationals are sitting at 500 at 19-19 and 17-17. And outside of them, there are five teams above 500 in the entire National League. So someone's going to make the playoffs with a not so great record. We saw with Arizona last year. And obviously they just went on a crazy tear to make the World Series. But look, someone is going to make it without having a good record. And we'll just have to see who that team is. But for now, technically the Nationals and the Mets and the Padres are actually fighting it out for that final playoff spot if the season were to end anytime soon. But luckily for us, we still have 130 games to go. So that is not going to be a relevant discussion for a while. One of those teams is probably going to go on a little run, and you know, it won't be an even 500 team or even like an 85 win team in the wild card by the end of the season. But then you have the Marlins, of course, one of the little three, as I'm now calling them, 10-27 on the season. Horrible pitching on this roster. I mean, look, I don't want to harp on it. They're a bad team overall, but they brought up a dude who has an 8 ERA in AAA, and he has been one of their better starters before the Dodgers rocked them yesterday. So, I mean, this team is just so depleted injury-wise, I just don't see how they stay competitive. And then they traded away Luis Arraez to make everything worse. So now they don't have as much offense in addition to the fact that their pitching staff isn't great. Then you have the Brewers in the Central, tied with the Cubs at the top, 20-14 for the Brewers, 21-15 for the Cubs. Cubs won that weekend series, like I said, but lost last night to lose their division lead. The Brewers have lost three in a row as well, though. But overall, these two teams are pretty good. I think they're the two you expect to compete at the top of the division. I had the Cubs here for sure, and then the Cardinals as kind of a contender, but they have been terrible. And then the Brewers, just a younger team that we don't know if we could trust this roster, but their young guys have come up and they performed really, really well. Christian Yelich had a great start to the season, hasn't played in a while, should be coming back maybe this week, maybe next week. But even without him, they played fine. Devin Williams hasn't pitched at all. He'll return later in the season. So the Brewers are honestly doing this shorthanded, but they're not blowing anybody out of the water. They're still having a good start to the season, though, and they deserve credit for that. And same thing with the Cubs. They've dealt with some injuries of their own. Cody Bellinger on the IL, of course. That's definitely making a big difference for this team in terms of their peak. Seiya Suzuki also on the IL. So a lot of offense missing for the Cubs, but they've scrapped together what they need. Justin Steele finally made his return from the IL last night after only pitching in the first game of the season. And then you have the Pirates at 17-19. They've won three in a row. I'll give them credit for being competitive, I guess, but they're just kind of a team like the Nationals. You know, they're one of those young teams that's, I still think, a little bit far away from actually having their, you know, strong breakout year. They're just not quite at that level yet. And then the Reds are 16-18. They have lost five in a row after a pretty strong start to the season. And like I said, at the bottom of the division, the really, really disappointing Cardinals, who are 15-20 on the year. Just a rough season for them. And finally, in the NL West, you have the Dodgers, who are 24-13. They have been on fire recently, 12-2 in their last 14. The Phillies, as I said, though, do still have the best record in the National League, but the Dodgers aren't too far behind with the second best record. And, you know, if you do the research on this, the Dodgers have not given up more than three runs in the last 14 games, except for one extra innings loss to the Diamondbacks. And also, they only lost a 4-3 game in extra innings and a 3-1 game to Toronto on the road. The Dodgers easily could have won 14 in a row. I mean, this team easily could be 14-0 in their last 14 and at 26-11 with the best record in all baseball. But, you know, those two losses happen. Sometimes the offense stalls out. But for the most part, the offense has been lights out recently, especially with Andy Páez kind of coming, not coming out of nowhere, if you follow Dodgers prospect news, but people don't really tend to follow prospect news as much, especially for teams that aren't their favorite. So, of course, I know about him, but not many others do. But then, getting off the Dodgers train, even though they're kind of the only team we're talking about, the Padres sitting at 19-19. The Arise trade is something that I don't really know how to react to. I mean, I think, you know, you always want to get great players and put them out there on the field. But I think the one thing this team definitely didn't need any more of was middle infield. That is the only thing they have on their team. That Cronenworth played as of 3 or 4 years ago. Ha-Seong Kim played shortstop. Xander Bogaerts played shortstop. Tatis played shortstop. Cronenworth played second base. Arise played second base. That's five middle infielders. Now, I know that Tatis is now an outfielder and, you know, you have the DH now to kind of rotate these guys in and out. Arise will probably DH for the most part. And Cronenworth has kind of moved to first base almost full time now. But I just don't, I feel like they needed an outfielder and probably a power bat more than they needed more contact in a middle infield position where he's probably not even going to play on defense because Ha-Seong Kim and Xander Bogaerts are your better defenders there. So it's a little bit, I mean, I guess I see why they wanted to get better, but it is just it's a little bit of a head scratcher. I feel like they could have used those prospects to get somebody who maybe suits their team better in terms of competing this year, if that is their intention. Then you have the Diamondbacks 15-20. You know, this team really just, they can't get, I don't really know how to describe it. They just kind of can't get off the ground. They've honestly played fine. Their run differential is plus seven. They have a better run differential than multiple teams with losing records, but better records than them, or even teams at 500 like the Nationals. They just can't stack together wins, which is obviously what the whole goal of any sport is. So just an unfortunate start for the Diamondbacks, but I still think luck will even out by the end of the season and they'll be a competitive team. They'll probably still compete for a playoff spot. You have the Giants at 15-21. Their record indicates that they are actually better than I think they actually have played. Their run differential is only better than the Rockies and the Marlins in the entire National League. I still think they have room to play better towards the end of the season. They just need to get their pitching staff in order, which just hasn't happened so far. And obviously, playing the Phillies over the weekend and getting swept in four games doesn't help what their record looks like either. And then finally, the Rockies, 8-26, only rivaled by the White Sox for the worst record in baseball. just not a good team at all. They've just allowed way too many runs. 2-8 in their last 10. They're not going to get any better either because their pitching staff is not injured. It's just not very talented in the first place.
All right. Well, that wraps our look at Major League Baseball for the week. It also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, May 14th, where we will once again look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, once again look back at NBA playoff action, and again have our weekly review of Major League Baseball action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including his picks for next weekend's games that will be posted, as always, on Thursday, and his Major League Baseball power rankings, which will be posted tomorrow. All of that content will be on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.